kind of short. I'm short, but not that short.
Good.
Hello, my name is Scott. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Scott.
I live in Gloucester. My sobriety date, I'm a COVID child, 12 October 2020. Before that, I really came into the program out of desperation, and that was December 8th, 2014. And I had a little bit to share about my COVID experience, and that's part of my story. And I have a home group, Live and Grow in Gloucester, Sunday nights. It's a closed, closed discussion. And I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. And I believe Steve knows my sponsor, Larry. And he gets on the circuit, but I haven't spoken in a while, but I don't know, it feels good to speak. And I guess I'll get right to it. I guess you could say I had a pretty good home life growing up. I have an older brother, older sister. My father, he fought alcohol for years, and I guess you could say he was a functional alcoholic. During his later years before he passed, he had, I guess you could say, not Alzheimer's, but dementia. And part of his dementia was his drinking. And he had to stop drinking in order to get out of his assisted living. And that's how he stopped drinking. And we all have our own way. And I had a good childhood. I remember back when I was a kid, though, I had this attraction to soda, especially cola. And back in those days, they had glass, 2-liter bottles. I'm kind of aging myself a little bit. But that was my real go-to when I was growing up. And I always loved it when my grandmother came to visit. And she loved having me hang around with her. And she was always drinking a tall glass of iced tea. And I thought it was iced tea. And as a kid, I was the go-to kid for the dry cellar. You know, the dry cellar for the booze. She used to drink, I used to fill up her glasses for her full of whiskey whenever she came to visit. And I didn't understand what it was. All I know is I remember that very well. And I always wondered why my father was so upset at her all the time. And that was part of the deal. She was a bad alcoholic and she died of cirrhosis of the liver. And I always remembered her before she passed, that she bloated out real big, and that was part of the disease. So it does run in the family, and my brother and sister are okay, but I was one of the lucky ones. And I kind of look at it that way. You know, we are a miracle. I truly believe that. So as I really started drinking, I guess, around 9 years old, camping with my buddies, we stole booze. I got pretty good stealing booze from my father early. And that was my first real drunk. We went camping and we drank a little bit of everything you could think of. Southern Comfort, that was my first time really getting drunk with Southern Comfort. And I got sick. I've never touched it since. Now, I'm not gonna say I wouldn't when I was in my drinking days, but I avoided it at all costs because Southern Comfort, especially when it goes through your nose, it's not good. And as a kid, you know, I'll never forget that. But there was that moment, though, when drinking, when it's like a magical moment, that feeling you get. And I was one of those. I guess I always will be. But so as high school progressed, I never really had bad consequences, but like at parties during high school, we always drank on weekends. And I was always the one, at the end of the party, they would have me running up and down the street. And I couldn't figure out what that was. I'm thinking back on it. They tried to get me to run, try to get it out of my system as much as possible before I would drive home. And my brother gave me a beater, 1973 Toyota Corolla, the orange one. And I proceeded to turn it into it looked like I was in a derby. I used to hit curbs. I used to run into trees. I really was a terrible driver. I'm just so lucky I didn't get a DUI when I was a kid. But back in those days, usually the local cops, they found you, they knew everybody. So they call my dad up and he'd come and get me or come get the car or someone else would take me home. So that's the way it was back in those days. But it gets worse and worse as time goes on, of course. And the consequences did get worse. When I went to college, I didn't make it past the freshman year because of my drinking. I went there on a soccer scholarship, and between the dope, acid, Quaaludes, and the booze, after the first year, I didn't make it to the next semester. And I played soccer in college, I played soccer in the Navy. However, my drinking, once again, one of my consequences. But I didn't look at it that way. I did the old, well, maybe I'll join the Navy. And I didn't realize it at the time. That was a geographical thing. Although the Navy, I did enjoy. And I decided volunteering for submarines would be kind of a neat thing to do. And that was really, let's just say it was something to do. I could not do it for more than 6 years because I was so burnt. But it is an adventure, and it's a tough life. But 2 weeks before boot camp, I got my first DUI, and this was in New Jersey. So my dad was scared to death. He got me a lawyer. Of course, I didn't tell my recruiter, and I got away with it. And that was another consequence, which I blew off. See, these things are, we have a tendency to do this, at least me. This is how I did it. And that was part of my geographical deal. But 2 weeks before boot camp, you get a DUI. I totally blew it off, scared my dad to death. And come find out, when I got out of the Navy, I went back to New Jersey, and they were looking for me, so I moved to Allentown to go to school. And because they finally hunted me down when the state started to work together, so I had to pay $3,000, and this is from 1980. They still do that now for charging you a certain amount. Back then it was like $1,500, but back in 2012 or 2013, it adds up. And once they got a hold of me, I had to pay that back. And it was like $1,500 in 1982. So it just goes to show you how things work. And I went to New Jersey, I'll never go back. And all my family moved out, they all moved back up to New Hampshire. Part of my family moved to Vermont. The only other family I have left is in Wyckoff, New Jersey. But when I got out of the service and went to New Jersey, it just totally changed. Now it's even worse. But, they call me a damn Yankee down here. And, they still, when I get excited, my accent comes out. But they still say down here that damn Yankees are the only Yankees that came here. In my case, I joined the Navy and was in Norfolk. I went back to New Jersey, couldn't stand it, came back here to stay. Now that's a damn Yankee. So, over the years, I had my problems. And in the early 90s, when I came back down here, because I blew everything off up in Allentown. I went to Moravian College in Allentown, burned all my VA money up from drinking, and once again, I just could not study. I got in trouble a little bit in Allentown. Once again, the consequences weren't bad enough for me, so I came back down and went to Virginia Beach, old Great Neck Road, a buddy of mine, Timmy. And I went to work for a company called Unidyne. And I worked as a contractor working on the boats again. And all this time my drinking was progressing, getting worse and worse and worse. And already at that time I'd been to Virginia Beach detox once. And it didn't faze me. And during that time before I went to the VA to rehab in 92, my parents came to see me. They were on their way to Florida. And I lived off of Tidewater Drive. And I was so bad that it totally scared my parents. And that was my second trip to Virginia Beach detox. And so life was going downhill. And of course, consequences didn't mean anything to me. It's amazing how you can have everything around you start to just tumble down around you. And it's like, yeah, I got this. You know, as long as you got the drink in you, you feel good. As long as you can kind of pay your bills. As long as my priorities were my booze and everything else I needed to do support that. And I was doing okay. I consider myself happy. And so Unidyne, I got fired from Unidyne. Well, actually let go. They wouldn't fire me, but they let me go. What's the difference, right? And they, you know, they all knew I had a bad drinking problem. And it ended like this. It was like 90 degrees outside, and my drinking was starting to get progressive. I was stopping to eat. I was just drinking. So I figured, well, because of the booze and everything, I said, well, maybe I'll get dressed up and go to work today. So what did I do? It's almost 90 degrees out. I had heavy corduroys, a sweater, and I was dressed like for the fall. And I went to work and I'm sweating, I'm all red, and I felt like shit. And, you know, a guy just finally put me to rest. He said, you have a serious problem. He said, don't you understand it's almost 90 degrees out here? Look at you. You're in corduroys, you're sweating, you got a sweater on, you know, and it didn't faze me. I mean, it was... So, I decided, well, I'm going to go back up to New Jersey to my folks. So I didn't know what else to do. So I said, well, I'm going to have one more trip down to Bill's Inn on Little Creek Road. That was our submarine bar. And that's where we always went when I was in the Navy. And I said, well, one last hurrah. So, I'm at the bar, I'm getting toasted, don't know anybody, and finally I meet these women. I'm headed out to my car, and these women, the kind of women of the evening, you would say. And I said, okay, sure, you know, what the heck. So there's two of the women with me. I go up to the ATM, and as soon as I get the money out of the ATM, they take my money. And of course, I lost my mind. So here I am drunk, almost a 3-2. Can't even stand hardly. So I get in my car and I think I'm going to try and run them over. So I'm going through this parking lot in the middle of Norfolk in the city, right there. And they had a big long cable. you know, to keep the cars in to say, you know, because you can't go in there and park, you know. So I got a little Plymouth Sundance, and I'm up against this cable, and I'm tearing the whole car up and burning rubber and everything, and then these Norfolk cops come up to me, and they're just laughing and laughing and laughing, and I try to tell them my story about these women who took my money, and needless to say, I went to the Norfolk City Jail. That was my first time there. And I was starting a DT, and Norfolk City Jail was not a happy place. And things started to hit me a little bit. And, you know, I gave away to all my cigarettes. I didn't know what to do. And then these policemen come running down the hall in the lockup. It was a big group lockup, like a big room like this. Run down with hoses. What's going on down there? Said they're just hosing off the, I guess, well, they said, well, I don't know, queers. And they're hosing them down because they're having a shit fight. And I just couldn't believe it. And it really, of all the things that hit me at that time, that really hit me, like, what am I doing here? And I was at a point of what I thought was my ending point of despair. But luckily, this man who, like, we have people that go to the jails now, to go to visit people, they have meetings in the jail. Well, they had the veterans come in and talk to other veterans. So luckily, this guy came in, and I was just in another, you know, I don't know. And he looked like Jim Brown to me with his little, that little hat, Muslim hat on. He looked like Jim Brown to me, and I called him Jim Brown, and he kind of laughed at me. But, needless to say, he got me into the VA in Hampton. And I went into their SART program. I don't even know if they have that program anymore. And luckily, I mean, it did save my life. I think it really did save my life. And I went through the 30-day, then they slowly weaned us off to, you know, like, had like a barracks kind of thing. Well, we went to meetings. I went to my home group was in the Hampton, near the Hampton Jail. I can't remember the name of the church, Seventh something, I think. But anyway, and I actually got a home group, and they gave us, we had little townhouses, we had groups of people, it was almost like an Oxford house, but not really. And I think I was doing all right. There's only one thing that I was not doing. I was not working the steps. I did not, I refused to get a sponsor. I got a home group, I helped set up and clean up a little bit. I didn't really talk to anybody. I didn't get involved in the fellowship. I didn't do the things that you're supposed to do, although I thought I was doing a pretty good job. And, you know, and I stayed sober for 2 years. But I also smoked a lot of dope, too. I had I lived in Buckrow Beach, and I had a neighbor. His name was Bill. And he loved smoking dope. So that was my go-to. And not drink, and I thought I was doing great. And I actually got a job at the Newport News Technological Park, working for a company called Opton. And I was starting to feel pretty good, although I was not really in the program. And we all know how that goes. And I stopped going to meetings, but I was still doing my thing, I thought. Until I met a woman who worked on the assembly line for Canon, because it was a Japanese company. And she asked me for a date. I said, okay. And she kind of knew where I was coming from, that I came from the VA. So she was born and raised in Guinea. And so we went on our first date, and somehow I mentioned that my what beer I like drinking. So she bought a six-pack of beer for me on our first date. So, being on my first date, well, of course I drank it. And I ended up marrying her. And there started my progression again, very slowly. And it just started to turn into a nightmare from there over the years. Until finally we separated our ways. The separation, I don't want to go into details of that, but bottom line is we separated and I still continued to drink and I went down that road. And finally in 2014, oh, the other thing, all those years, I think I might be the I knew the judge, first name basis. She always said, "Hello, Mr. Moore, how are you?" I think I was the only one in Gloucester to get drunk in public in my own yard 3 times. And I just had a habit of, I don't know whether it's a neighbor calling the cops to keep my wife from killing me, I don't know what. But, and CSB, you know, CSB there, you know, they have the ASAP and they have, I've been at everything they have in there. At least 3 times. And it just never stuck. And I had my powerlessness, I just couldn't figure it out. My idea of powerlessness was I couldn't figure out how to drink correctly. You know, all the lists of all the different things you need to do, try different booze, different this, different that. I just didn't think I was doing it right. So as soon as I feel a little bit better, I just slowly start back up again. And it just always the consequences. And the insanity of it all. It's just amazing how we just can't figure it out. And finally I hit that dropping off point though. I was over my neighbors, they were great enablers for me. I loved them to death, I still do. They just don't understand why I don't come over there that much anymore. I mean, I'm sociable with them to a point. But I went over, I drank some of this cinnamon twist moonshine, whatever that is, cinnamon apple, whatever it is, it's moonshine. And I was drinking with other things and I puked up blood in a 5-gallon bucket. I almost filled the bucket up, but it scared me to death. So it was starting to get to me because I was drinking at work, I was drinking, it was terrible. And I was at the point where if I drank, it started really hurting me and making me feel terrible. And if I stopped, I started to feel even worse. I was hitting that point of no return, that point to where you just, what am I gonna do? And so I forced myself to stop all weekend. And I was starting really, I wasn't feeling right. I was starting to get blinking lights and things. And my neighbor, I wish he would have, he came and asked me if I was okay and I should have listened to him. But I decided I was gonna try to drive to work. I mean, I didn't have anything in my system, at least getting in trouble wise. So on my way to work, I started going to Grand Mal Caesars, and then I totaled my truck, and I was in ICU for a little over 10 days. And my neighbor said he didn't think I was gonna come out of it, but I did. But I'll tell you what, when I woke up in that ICU and it was just dark, that's when the clarity hit me. And that's terrible for a clarity to hit you at that point. And that's where I really asked for God to help me. I'll never forget it. That was my clarity point, my desperation point. And for whatever reason, you know, it was just before Christmas. And I got out of the hospital. My neighbors took me out to dinner and we spent Christmas together. And I even started seeing a therapist. psychiatrist therapist over at CSB in January, and I felt calm and I wasn't drinking. And it didn't even, the urge was not there. And I don't know whether it was the hospital, because, you know, whatever drugs there were, I didn't need them anymore. But the urge was gone. And not that I didn't think about it. But then I went to one session with the woman. She finally said, you know, they have a newcomers meeting. It's Wednesday. Newcomers meeting at 5:30 in CSB. They don't have it there now. They have it at Salvation Army. But and that's where I met my sponsor, Larry, my sponsor. And it took me 3 months to get the courage to ask him. But at least I started going to meetings. I started getting involved. And then working with Larry, Larry's trip, I love him to death. He had a way of getting me to go to new meetings. It was incredible. He just try it. Go ahead. So I go to the Friday night 12 and 12, which I still go to regularly, the Friday night 12 and 12. And this was my sobriety date then was December 8th, 2014. And I was starting to like this thing. And Larry was getting me to go to meetings almost 6 times a week. And we had a bunch of us back here, you know, that came with me here. We're a group. We have our own group text together. And, you know, we were doing things together. We were bowling. I remember first time after 12 and 12 meeting, actually went out to dinner first time without being drunk or anything. And there's booze in there. We went to Juan's, I think, in Gloucester. We all sat at a table. Scared me to death because I looked over and there's booze everywhere. All the people that took me to the place to eat dinner, they're all talking and having fun. Finally, I figured this out. They got something I don't have yet, and I want it. They can have fun without drinking. And it used to piss me off when people used to say, you don't have to be this way anymore. I said, what do you mean I don't have to be this way anymore? It is so true. You know, when people say that, you don't have to be this way anymore if you don't want to. And that is so true. So, so from there, the program started to really become a part of my life. Sobriety started to become a part of my life. And to see that newcomers meeting, over time, it just turned out that that's where I went. I worked in Kilmarnock. I get off work. I go right to CSB every Wednesday, help set up the meeting, and I did that for years. And that was my thing. That's what I needed. That was the commitment I needed. The thing that got me to do something on a regular basis to help others. And I guess we all kind of know, but I was helping myself too. And that's, to me, that's the key. So my sponsor, Larry, he took me through the steps. And it's amazing how this book, I remember reading it when I was in the VA. It looked like a bunch of gobbledygook. I really didn't understand it. I thought it was like I was reading the Bible. But now, that's... Well, I can mention it now. I mean, like 3 or 4 years ago, we started going to church, a few of us, and, you know, AA is primary, but now I go to church now and I look at religion a little bit differently now. And in a way, AA and God has helped me understand religion in a different way. Because I'll tell you one thing, the religion might go away someday, I don't know. AA will always be, because AA is what saved my life. And I firmly believe that. And so the steps were very important to me. And I'll never forget about my 8-month part, when I had a few people, especially CB from the Sunday night group, she came up to me and she said, you know, you've really changed. And she always speaks to the, when you see the miracle happen, and when you see that, there is a point, at least for me, there was a point when I started kind of understanding, but actually to me, it almost felt like things started getting a little bit easier. And when people started speaking in the meeting, I could kind of understand where they were coming from. And then the same token, if I got a chance to share, I started to feel better and started to become a part of. And right now we have, there's a group of us, six of us core. We have a group text. We started that years ago and we still do it to this day. And I'm a sponsee. Mike came to visit, Bill, Brittany, Mike, and Jimmy, and you know, we're a good group together, and we help each other. And that's where I like to share a little bit with you about becoming a COVID child, I call it. I was gonna say COVID baby, that don't sound right. COVID child. I didn't do well with this COVID and shutdown thing, because like in March, all of a sudden, everything shut down. All the meetings shut down, everything shut down. And I didn't think too much of Zoom. It's amazing how Zoom just kind of took off, and how the assemblies, that's something else I'd like to talk about. But you know how they fight about it, but not this time. They let Zoom, and the Zoom meetings thing has taken off. And, you know, the AA program as a whole, I think, accepts Zoom. But I was having a hard time with it. And so back in the late summer of 2020, I just kind of drifted away. I mean, I started setting myself up. I mean, I drive home through West Point. So this is incredible how insane we can be, cunning and baffling. I said, well, I'm going to Best Buy. I want to get a laptop. So I started going to Best Buy once or twice a week. And then I started going to the Target while I was going to the Best Buy. And meanwhile, I'm cutting all the way through from Kilmarnock through West Point and then cutting through Williamsburg. And I started doing this on a continuous basis because I had no meetings to go to. So I'm going to find something to do. Yeah, what I started to do, I started buying boxed wine. I don't even drink wine. But I did. And, you know, just started walking in. I'll buy a few things here, a few things there. Then, you know, I'm walking around, I see this boxed wine. And then I put it in the cart, and I put other stuff on top of it and hide it. You know, we're insane people, at least me. And then that's just where it went. And I was not having fun at all. And you know, they say AA can ruin your next drunk or whatever the saying is. You know, AA, it was not fun. It didn't feel good. But it was like I didn't know what to do. You know, I get off work and I just didn't know what to do. I was like, but I had all these people, you know, in the group text and all that. But somehow I lost something. And then finally, you know, one of the fellas, Jimmy, they came by and kind of intervened because I stopped going to church. They come banging on my door, and there I am, and there I'm slowly just doing my thing, you know. And I never called in sick to work, but I called in sick. So they stopped by, and Larry, my sponsor, came by also. And I thank God for that. And that same evening, and that was October 12th, 2020, I went back to the men's meeting, picked up another white chip. So that's why I call myself COVID child. So, I mean, I like talking about my previous, you know, sobriety date, because That's, to me, that's when I really got it. I mean, you know, when you start to really accept the program as it is, start to accept your life as it is, and then, you know, what happened, happened. And I got to talk with my sponsor, Larry, about that. We had a discussion about it. And there were some things I was missing. I wasn't really doing my meditating. I wasn't really doing any reflective time. So each morning now, I've been doing this for years, and the fellas know, I put it on the group text. I do a meditation each morning. I take a walk with my dog. I meditate. I pray. And I've never done that before. I never really did, had any real time developing a relationship with my higher power. I mean, it might sound cliche, but it's true. And it's very important to have a relationship with your higher power, and which I call God. And I wasn't doing any of those things, so I had nothing really to fall back on if I didn't have the program, because that's what happened, at least to me, during COVID. There was nothing. Other people had other ways they dealt with it. To me, the meetings were very important in my life. District was very important. And it just all went away. And so, just for me, that really helped shore up my program. And I've always been involved with service work. That's key. Because my sponsor, he's a big one on the service work. And God bless him. And I think I'm on, it seems like I'm on my fourth or fifth year of GSR, because, you know, because COVID happened, we lost a lot of people. And for a point there during COVID, they didn't have any district. They didn't have assemblies. So, but I still do that, and I'm still in district. I'm the workshop chair. And it's very important. It's a shame. It seems it's hard for others to get involved. But you can't force anybody to do anything. And the old saying is, how did you become GSR? I don't know. I sat down and someone picked me. Well, I don't know if that always happens, but in a kind way, it does, you know. Kind of rambling, but so to me, service work is critical, and I do have a sponsee here. I sponsor people. I do have a new sponsee I'm working with, and I enjoy that. And I go to Wakefield. I want to do a shout out for Wakefield. I've been there 5 times, and you know, I enjoy that. And I went to my first, is it called Oceanfront? Went to our first Oceanfront conference, and that was something to see. It was incredible. And as far as 8 and 9, the amends part, that was kind of a way of releasing myself. I did my 4-step with my sponsor and found out that I had a real bad habit of isolating, and that's how my disease worked. And I protected myself, and you never realize how much you isolate yourself from your family and hurt your family until you get out of wherever you're at as far as your alcoholism. And a lot of my family didn't feel so bad, because some of them hadn't seen me for almost 20 years. You know, you just kind of fade away. And then others, they just get sick of your shit. And I got to talk to my mom. She was in hospice, and I got to talk to her 3 months when I was 3 months sober. And I sat down with her for quite some time. And I was really bad back in the early 90s. In 1992, she attended Al-Anon to deal with me and to help get her life better. You know, trying to, you know, Al-Anon is a good way of understanding how bad we can be. And God bless her. I mean, and she went to Al-Anon meetings, you know, in Florida too. You don't really know how bad you are until, you know, it's all over, said and done. And sometimes you can't really say you're sorry. You can just live a better life. You know, be a better person. You know, the commandments. Do the right thing. And, you know, I think I've done that with my family. And kind of choked me up with my mom because, God, it's incredible how people can stick by you. Then again, she also told me about my grandmother, which I didn't know either. And that kind of threw me for a loop there. I knew she was sick, but nobody would ever tell me what she was sick of and why she died, you know. And so 8 and 9 are very important. My ex-wife and I, it's best that that's one of those. If we never meet, that's a good thing. That's one of those where we could hurt each other or who knows. I mean, it's a great life. And acceptance was a big thing for me. And I found this. You have an, in the big book, acceptance was the answer, you know, as far as, I forget the name of the old
song. Addict and Alcoholic.
Yeah. But I don't like the old classic one. I like on page 420. Acceptance is the key to my relationship with God today. I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for Him to tell me what to do. Rather, I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to Him, however it turns out. And that's God's will for me. And that kind of fits me with the way my life is and how I look at acceptance. Because to me, acceptance, there is action. And I love that chapter about action. That's kind of a cool name, Into Action. Mm-hmm. And but that is true. But you can only take it so far. You start acting out, overacting out your actions and going over and above and beyond God's will. Then you start trying to take control and then things just turn to shit. And for some people it's easier than others. I just try to remember that. And another, speaking of into action, on page 83, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And I firmly believe that. I mean, they say this is a living, you know, we're learning how to live a new life. And, you know, not perfection. We just want progress. And man, I'm happy today. And without the program, I don't know where I would be. And the fellowship to me is amazing. I don't know what else to say about the fellowship part of it. And I never knew it like back in those early days when I was in the VA. I went to meetings and I just kind of sat around. I just looked at people. And I kind of listened to what they're saying. I said, you ain't like me. What? You're fucking crazy. And then, you know, like, we go to the river, to the hospital meeting. I think that was on Wednesdays. Oh, okay, thanks. And I used to listen to people share there, and some of them I see all the time. And I used to think they were crazy. And it just shows you how far we can go. And
uh,
really, only thing I can say is that Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, and it's given me a new life. And I have a lot of new friends and new family. And this is where I need to be. And AA has saved my life. So that's it.